Christina Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have.
Welcome in. Legal Face Off is live on WGN, WGNRadio.com. The Legal Eagles are here. It's Rich Linkoff, Tina Martini, Sam Panionovich, and Ben Anderson. Final episode of July.
The Legal Face Off Studios, as I'm calling them.
Yes.
I mean, we've been here for so long. We ought to be.
We should have our names on the
door. Yeah, come on. Who's a bigger star than Martini and Lenkov here at WGN?
I don't have an answer for that.
All right.
I have no answer for that. We're going to talk
speechless
about Mueller, monsters, cannabis, and then, of course, legal grab bag at the end of the show. But joining us to lead things off, she is a return guest on this program, professor from practice at the University of Chicago Law School, assistant attorney general in the criminal appeals section, former United States Attorney's Office, and also the chief administrator of COPPA back in the day. She is Sharon Fairley, and she rejoins us here on Legal Faceoff. Welcome, professor. Welcome back.
Well, thanks for having me.
Sharon, so much to unwrap, obviously.
Sure, there's a lot.
With the Mueller testimony of 2 days ago, but I'm still personally getting my head around everything that went on that day. In many ways, nothing new, but very fascinating stuff came out of it. So we're going to focus, of course, given that we're a legal show, on some legal issues
sure.
We want to get your perspective on. So first of all, what did you make of the idea that while Mueller is not above the law, he's not also below the law? That was stated by Representative Radcliffe. In other words, if there wasn't enough evidence that Trump obstructed or colluded, then why shouldn't he enjoy the same presumption of innocence afforded to any other American? That was obviously a big topic of discussion and, you know, a big point that the Republicans were pushing. So what are your thoughts on that?
I mean, I think you've got a couple of legal disciplines kind of wrapped up together in this concept, right? But the thing that I think that at the end of the day we need to remember is that we have this special counsel regulation for a reason. The special counsel regulation is all about the criminal process. So when that process is invoked, it's really meant to assess criminal culpability. And when it applies to the president, yes, it's more complicated because then you have some constitutional challenges with regard to that. But it still is it's all about gathering evidence to see if there's enough to prove a criminal case. And where there is, then that case should be presented to a court. Now, when you have the president, clearly the Department of Justice has gone on record saying that they don't believe that a sitting president can be indicted. And I think if you look at the regulations, the way it's really supposed to work is when this happens, you have this investigation, and then the process really should play out that Congress should undertake impeachment, which would remove the president from office so that he then could be indicted and charged with a crime. And so I think that we're in the thick of figuring out how that whole thing is going to work, if it's going to happen, and how it should happen. And so it's messy. It's just never happened before. So it's, you know, we're rife with complex challenges here.
Sharon, the Mueller report actually documents many examples of contacts between the Trump campaign and the Russian government, and Mueller confirmed that a couple of days ago. Why isn't that enough to prove a conspiracy? And is it because Trump can't be prosecuted under DOJ guidelines as a sitting president?
Yeah, and so the thing about conspiracy, so when you think about the law of conspiracy, a conspiracy is really just a legal term that refers to an agreement between two or more people to do something illegal. And so what I think Mueller was trying to say in his report is, like, look, we have all these contacts between the Trump campaign and the Russian government. But contacts in and of themselves is just not enough. You have to prove that there was this underlying agreement that something illegal was going to be done. And I think that's where he was maybe finding it might have been tough with the evidence that he had to prove, you know, that agreement. And again, of course, it has to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. But this is one of the things that I found most really disturbing about the way people talk about this report, that, you know, there's been discussion about, you know, all these claims of no collusion, no collusion, no collusion. Well, that's simply not true. What the report says is there wasn't enough proof to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that there was a conspiracy, but there was certainly a lot of evidence that could have happened.
Yeah, it's just frustrating. I've been watching the story, as we all have, forever, and it's just incredibly frustrating. I'm sure you might feel the same way as a former, you know, AUSA. Why didn't Mueller just simply say, I mean, to your earlier point, why didn't Mueller simply just come out and say, yes, there are examples of contacts, maybe collusion, and also of obstruction. I mean, there's clear, you know, any first-year law student would recognize that these are acts of obstruction. Why did he just say that and then say in plain English, but I can't prosecute it because of this DOJ guideline, and, you know, he should be prosecuted once he leaves office or impeached? I mean, that's just plain English. Why couldn't he just do that?
So I completely share your frustration on this issue. When I first got the report, you know, and reading the report and reading the explanation for why he did not make the prosecutorial decision, it didn't make any sense to me. It was a very unsatisfying explanation, because in my view, that's the whole point of the special prosecutor regulations, is it so that a prosecutorial decision can be made. And so that was a big question that I was hoping to have answered in the hearings, but was really, it remains unanswered.
So what's your opinion? I mean, you've been behind the scenes in these rooms. You've been in these meetings. Like, do you think it was Mueller trying to not take a position? Do you think he was worried politically? Do you think he didn't want to be there? I mean, like, why do you think he sort of stopped short of crossing the football across the end zone?
Well, I think it's because, you know, he's a career DOJ person, and it's a really core value at the agency that you just don't wade into political waters. And my guess is, and of course, you know, I don't know what's going on in his head, but it certainly stands to reason that you would imagine he's worried about having too much influence on the political process. He didn't want to push the issue. He wanted to provide the information and then let Congress take it from there. Now, I mean, that to me is just a little bit gun-shy. I believe that the special counsel's regulation is there for a reason, and the whole point of it is, in fact, to make a prosecutorial decision. And as I said, I think the way the system is set up to work is that even if you can't indict a sitting president, you can indict him once he leaves office, and you can engage in the process of impeachment to get him out of the office so that he then can be indicted. And so I just, you know, I also share in your frustration about that.
So, Sharon, while Mueller established that Trump could still be charged by future prosecutors after he leaves office, Chicago Democrat Mike Quigley pointed out the statute of limitations on federal obstruction charges is 5 years. So what happens? You know, Trump may win re-election in 2020, in which case he wouldn't leave the office until 2025, long after charges for such a crime are no longer possible. But if he loses, how likely are criminal charges?
Yeah, so this is a legal question that I just don't have the answer to as I sit here today. I just haven't researched the issue. So when you have a, you know, the whole point of a statute of limitations with a crime, right, is you want to make sure that the government has a reason and has a motivation to prosecute the crime in a timely basis, because over time, memories fade, evidence is lost, and it just becomes more difficult for a defendant to defend their case, right, because they can't gather the evidence and so on and so forth. But there are circumstances under which statutes of limitations can be told, right? So the sort of the clock will stop under certain circumstances. What I can't answer for you, as I sit here today, just because I haven't done the research, is whether this situation would fall within one of those reasons why you would toll a statute of limitations. So, you know, I know Mr. Representative Quigley was sort of saying that he thought that the statute of limitations could run while the president was sitting in office, but I just don't know the answer to that question. I haven't done the research myself.
That is Professor Sharon Fairley, University of Chicago Law School, return guest on Legal Faceoff. Professor, thank you so much.
Thank you, guys. Have a great day.
You are listening to Christina Martini on Legal Faceoff. Dina is a partner at McDermott, Will & Emery and focuses her practice on domestic and international trademark and copyright law, as well as domain name, internet, social media, advertising, and unfair competition law. Tina has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubbell and being selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications, including Chambers & Partners and World Trademark Review. Tina is also the recipient of the Anti-Defamation League's Women of Achievement Award and has been recognized by Crain's Chicago Business as one of Chicago's most influential minority lawyers. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is an author, columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host, and she frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current issues and trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. McDermott, Will & Emery is an integrated international law firm. McDermott has an uncompromising commitment to legal excellence, extraordinary client service, and a high-performance culture. It is committed to helping clients achieve stellar legal and business results today and well into the future. To contact Tina and to learn more about McDermott, Will & Emery, visit MWE.com.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. Time to talk some cannabis law. And to do so, we welcome in David S. Ruskin, a partner at HMB Legal Counsel, HMBlaw.com. I'm excited to talk cannabis, Rich. You know that.
You look like you've been excited to discuss it or do something else with cannabis this
I have
morning.
A red shirt and red eyes right
Absolutely.
Now.
Absolutely.
Wow. Okay. No pressure, David. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Hi.
So you counsel various companies and entrepreneurs in the cannabis industry. And last month, Governor Pritzker signed the Illinois Cannabis Bill into law, making Illinois the 11th state in the country to legalize the recreational use and purchase of marijuana. Can you walk us through the law, which takes effect on January 1st?
Well, I could walk you through the law. It's 600 plus pages, so longer than the Mueller report. We're going to be here a while.
Wow.
But I can give you some highlights.
Well, like highlights.
Yeah, sure.
Absolutely.
So starting January 1st, adults who are 21 years and over will be allowed to purchase and possess and consume marijuana without having a medical card, medical authorization, which was... up until January 1st, for the last, since January of 2014, we've had the compassionate use of medical cannabis. So so starting January 1st, 2020, it will be adult use. And in addition to that, Illinois has come up with some new licenses that will be allowed. So in addition to dispensaries that are selling cannabis, cultivation licenses that grow the cannabis, Illinois has now come up with a new craft grower license, kind of to suit the smaller growers, kind of like the craft brewers.
Okay.
So there's a also a infuser license. So if you want to actually take cannabis and put it into products, you're going to need an infuser license. There's a transporter license for transporting cannabis from cultivation facilities to dispensaries. So there's a bunch of different licenses that weren't around before.
Okay.
Let's talk about that for a second, David, because you, you know, in addition to being an attorney, you actually counsel businesses on how to deal with cannabis-related businesses. You wrote an article in Practical Law about this, which was very interesting. I was reading about this convention downstate recently where prospective owners were meeting to learn how to get into this business. Obviously, there's a lot of people who want to get in on the green rush, as they're calling it. Sure. Some liken it to prospecting back in the late 19th century. How difficult is the state going to make it to get a license to sell or be involved in the cannabis industry?
Well, listen, if you held a medical license, or you currently hold a medical license, it's not going to be difficult at all. You're going to be allowed essentially first dibs at the new adult use license. And then following that, Illinois will be coming out with applications for new businesses, folks that want to get into the new businesses, which will be coming out. Applications will be approved for dispensing, selling, and growing next year in 2020, mid-2020 to the end of 2020. And then, you know, it's kind of like let's see what happens, what the supply and the demand is like, and before we determine, the state determines whether or not more licenses are going to come available in 2021. There's options to kind of tweak that so that there could be more or less. Illinois did something that they've been working on for a long time, which is for this new law, which is a social equity component, which is going to allow people who have been impacted through the war on drugs over the years to get easier access to capital, easier access to get these licenses. It's certainly by no means going to be easy, and there's going to be a lot of competition. But the fact that Illinois has now incorporated the social equity component is tremendous. It's great. And it took a long time. I know Illinois wanted to be, as the 11th state that has adult use, they wanted to be kind of the gold standard for going forward for other states that are looking at this, this social equity component. And so they've done a good job. And essentially, if an owner of a business has more than 51% ownership or more than 51% of their employees are from disproportionately impacted areas around the state, then they're going to get extra points on their application.
So a quick question about people who were formerly, you know, who have criminal records as a result of either purchasing or possessing 30 grams or less of marijuana. Apparently, there are at least 800,000 people in the state of Illinois that fall in that bucket. And one of the aspects of the new law that's been getting a lot of airplay is the fact that it looks like those criminal records are going to be expunged. Is that right?
Right. I mean, that's another big part of the social equity component is essentially what's been called an automatic expungement for, I think the number is around 750,000 or mm-hmm. so for those who have been arrested or convicted for that marijuana offense.
Do you think that's the right result, given that it was illegal at the time that those arrests came down?
Yeah, I do. I know Illinois is being careful about not also including situations that included different offenses at the same time. So, you know, if you had a firearm or something else at the same time, that's not automatically expunged.
Okay.
But I think, sure, if, look, we could talk about this, you know, a lot, but depending on how you feel about the illegality of cannabis itself, the fact remains in Illinois, starting January 1st, it's essentially going to be a legal. It's going to be legal. So the fact that these arrests were for cannabis possession, now that it's legal, it makes sense to expunge those. And, you know, frankly, a lot of those arrests and convictions really were minor, and certainly the offense that the arrests were based on really probably never should have happened in the first place, mm-hmm. but they did, and now this is an opportunity for us to make good on that.
Another really popular question, David, is where can I buy, right? And I don't know if you know these exact answers, but I've been privy to some information. Rocket Bar and Grill is on Hubbard Street here in River North. Rocket has been bought out by a dispensary. They sold the building and the business is closed because guess what? A dispensary will be on Hubbard Street soon. I don't know if you knew that or not, but do you have any idea where these dispensaries could be, where we could go, where people could go to buy marijuana?
Sam means like now.
Right.
Not starting January 1st. He wants
to
know.
He has this rabid look on his eyes.
We can talk about that afterwards, but starting January 1st, first of all, any of the current medical dispensaries are going to be allowed to sell adult use as well at that location. So that's, you can tell right now where those 55 locations are. And then on top of that, Illinois is going to spread them out based on population. So my recollection is the Chicagoland area will have 47. I think that's been decided right now in the law, 47 dispensary licenses. And then spread out around the state depending on the population. I've heard about the Rocket bar and what's going on. It's up to the Department of Professional Financial Responsibility, IDFPR, that governs that. So we'll see if they approve it.
David, you work with lots of companies, privately held companies, startups, in developing business plans and all of the issues that go in with starting a business. How does starting a cannabis-related business differ from a traditional company that you work with, if any? Give us a couple of highlights of how they differ, maybe.
Yeah, there's some real significant differences. Because of the illegality at the federal level, we've got this tension between state and federal law. And so businesses need to be cognizant of that. One issue that comes up all the time is banking. right? The traditional, whether it's getting a depository account at a bank, which you can't do typically with a cannabis business, getting a traditional loan or getting capital to start that business and keep the business running is much more difficult with cannabis-related businesses. So that's the primary issue.
So how do you do it? How do you get a loan?
Cash.
Yeah.
No. I mean, there are non-traditional lenders that are out there, but it's hard. It's certainly a lot harder than the typical startup or the business in other industries. And it's really the only industry like that.
Sounds like the feds are going to overturn it, make it legal at some point, given the wave, the green wave, some would say, across the country in legalization of marijuana. Seems logical the federal government would declassify it at some point.
We are moving in that direction.
Yeah.
And I think probably what we'll see first is, before a complete descheduling, probably something along the lines of the States Act. There's a couple bills that are in play right now, States Act, the SAFE Act, that'll allow, if a particular state is legal, then that'll be, you'll be okay in that particular state.
All right, that's David S. Ruskin, partner at HMB Legal Counsel, hmblaw.com, to learn more. David, thanks for stopping in. Really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
We all know the legal world is complex and high-pressured. There's no room for error. That's why judges and attorneys across Chicagoland have trusted the expert court reporters at McCorkle Litigation Services since 1948. McCorkle Litigation Services has accurately recorded every word from thousands of legal proceedings. McCorkle Litigation Services provides the legal community with peace of mind, transcribing testimony and depositions that can be used reliably by jurors, judges, and attorneys. For all your legal support needs, contact McCorkle Litigation Services online at McCorkleLitigation.com.
You can follow the show on Twitter. You can like us on Facebook. You can always search on iTunes where you get your podcasts. Legal Face Off WGN Radio to rate, review, and of course, listen to the show. Rich Lenkoff and Tina Martini, you're here. And joining us now on the phones, he's a Chicago cinematographer. His website is markmanet.com, and he's also the director of a brand new documentary, a crime documentary, Defending a Monster. It's Mark Manet and Scott Preston, produced by Rich Lenkoff. And it debuted in Melbourne this past week. So Mark is going to join us right now on Legal Face-Off. Mark, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Produced mostly by Mark Manet, Scott Preston, and some other very notable local producers, it should be said. I was a very small cog in this machine. This was the Manet and Preston show, again, with some other local filmmakers. But yeah, great to have you, Mark, on Legal Face-Off.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm really excited.
So John Wayne Gacy, obviously a notorious figure in the history of not just Chicago, but of America, one of the most notorious serial killers ever, I think 33 victims. And you and Scott decided to take a different perspective at his life, but also, importantly, the trial that Sam Amirante was involved in. So explain to our listeners who Sam is and how you became involved, how you and Scott became involved in the story.
It's kind of a long story, but the short version is that one of our executive producer, Joe Kless, had an association with Sam. I think they'd worked together in the past, and you know he'd heard about Sam had come out with his book with Danny Broderick called "Defending a Monster." So our film's actually based on that book. And so Scott and Joe were working on a project, and Scott made me aware, like, "Hey, this book's coming out. What do you think we should do?" And I had just worked on a documentary called What's the Matter with Kansas? And I was a cinematographer on that. But I saw this really great model where the director, you know, optioned a book that had a following. And, you know, it was basically gives you the blueprint for the film. And I thought we could replicate that with this book. So, you know, instead of trying to do a feature film like a narrative, I proposed the idea of let's do a documentary. And so we all had a great dinner. We met Joe, Sam, myself, Scott, and we talked about the project, we talked about the book, and then it went from there.
So, Mark, the presumption of innocence and the right of every defendant to receive capable representation is a bedrock principle of our legal system. How did those concepts guide Sam's advocacy for Gacy?
So what's interesting is, I'll just start, I was the only non-lawyer in this whole project. Rich is a lawyer, Joe is a lawyer, Sam was a lawyer, then became a judge. And so I was actually, one of the things I learned the most, I don't about Gacy, I definitely learned more about Gacy, but one of the things I learned the most, to be honest, while doing this production was about our legal system. I mean, I, you know, obviously what I've been taught in school growing up, but I was fascinated by the respect that the legal team on both sides really, you know, had for Sam and had for what he did. And the Judge Grippo, could not have more kind words to say about the job that Sam did defending Gacy. I mean, you know, there's this idea, I think, for many people when you have somebody who's so obviously guilty, you know, just the flip the switch or to you know, just throw him to the wolves. But, you know, our legal system is based on this idea that everybody, regardless of how heinous their crimes, deserves a defense. And Sam happened to be that person.
Yeah, it's really one of the fascinating aspects of the story. And again, we've all, you know, heard about Gacy and serial killers, but I can't remember taking it from the legal perspective and from the person who had to, you know, listen to Gacy and understand where he was coming from. And again, provide him with his constitutional right to effective counsel. So the other thing I think the film really does well is educate viewers on the insanity defense, because, you know, Gacy, who was tried over the course of 5 weeks, even though the jury was out a very short time, the trial took 5 weeks. His main theory of defense was insanity. So tell us a little bit about what you learned about that defense and how the film deals with that aspect of the representation of Gacy.
Yeah, I think to your earlier point, I mean, one of the things with this film we really wanted to be, you know, we were well aware of is that there's a lot of Gacy films out there. So our film has Gacy as a presence, but it's really more about the people involved. And like you said, about the trial. And obviously, insanity plays a real key role in the trial. And what I learned, I guess, more than anything, was that, you know, how open to interpretation, especially at that time, that defense was. You know, you obviously had experts on both sides saying insane, not insane. And really, ultimately, it was up to the jury to decide whether they believed he, you know, his crimes lived up to the criminal definition of insanity. And I guess as a non-lawyer, I was totally unaware of the idea of being, you know, there's a clinical insanity, but there's also a criminal insanity. And the differences between those two, because, you know, if you think about it, and in the film it's mentioned, you know, if the insanity defense doesn't apply to somebody like Gacy, who would it apply to? And it was really an education for me to learn the difference, like the idea of somebody just being insane as in a medical state, but insane as a criminal, and as well, like in a courtroom situation. So it definitely plays a central role in our film. There's a moment where one of the witnesses basically says out loud that if the jury found him insane, that there's a chance that someday he would walk free. And Sam objects, but Sam said basically at the time that once the toothpaste is out of the tube, you can't put it back in. So once the jury had it in their head that, you know, if they found him insane, there's a chance that this guy could be walking around, he felt that it basically sort of tainted the jury for the insanity defense.
Mark, there's been a lot of pushback on recent films depicting serial killers like Ted Bundy as sympathetic, and of shows like You, which make a murderous stalker the hero. Were you concerned that you would make one of the most prolific serial killers in history a likable figure?
Oh, gosh, no. We were definitely aware and sensitive to that, but we weren't concerned because our film, you know, Gacy's in the title and it's about Gacy, but really our film, if I'm going to be honest, the real star of our film is the criminal justice system. It's the American Constitution, and really it's the people that Gacy touched. So our film, we have to talk about Gacy just to set it up, especially because the current generation, it's, you know, 40 years ago now. So the current generation, we basically had to just give a little bit of a primer to set up the history of it. But our film is really more about the people involved in the case. And I think that's why it's different than other films. We're not glamorizing his actions in any way. If anything, it's really about Sam. It's about the prosecution. It's about this case in particular. So it definitely has a little bit of a twist on your typical, you know, I would even be hesitant to throw us in with the serial killer, the lump of a lot of these other recent films. Ours happens to be about a serial killer, but it's really about the trial of the serial killer more than his actions itself.
His name is Mark Manet, the website markmanet.com, Chicago cinematographer and the director, along with Scott Preston, of Defending a Monster, which just debuted in Melbourne, produced by Rich Lankoff. Mark, thanks for joining us. Good luck with everything.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Rich Lankoff is an insurance defense attorney with Bryce Downey & Lankoff. Rich is consistently recognized by clients for his outstanding litigation results. In 2015, Target named him their top outside litigation attorney in the country. Rich has received a number of industry accolades, including Illinois Super Lawyer from 2015 through 2018 and Leading Lawyer from 2012 through 2018, designations given to less than 5% of Illinois attorneys. Rich is also an active member of his community, including serving on the Lincoln Park High School Local School Council, the advisory board of Legal Prep Charter Academy, and the board of visitors for the Northern Illinois University College of Law. In addition to his full-time legal practice, Rich is a producer with credits, including 85, The Greatest Team in Football History, starring former President Barack Obama, Bill Murray, and Mike Ditka, and Renegades, a live show production at Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas, starring Terrell Owens, Jose Canseco, and Jim McMahon. In addition to co-hosting Legal Faceoff since 2013, Rich is the legal analyst for several WGN shows, including The Bill and Wendy Show and Patty Vasquez with Andrea Darlis. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service litigation firm practicing general liability, workers' compensation, professional liability, business transactions, construction law, and intellectual property. For more information about Rich and Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, please visit bdlfirm.com.
And it's time for the legal grab bag here on Legal Faceoff. That's how we always wrap things up. Thanks to Ben Anderson. My name is Sam Paniatovich. Rich Lenkoff, Tina Martini, another solid jam-packed show.
Wow. Lots of legal action going on.
I just need more legal face-off swag.
Yes.
I don't have the swag that everybody else gets when they get
here.
Do we
have extra swag for our
guests? I've got extra swag
right.
for you.
Well, swag me up, Tina, as we welcome in our guests on the grab bag today. Alex Godieri, who is the Director of Business Development at Utopic. Welcome, Alex.
You're welcome.
And Patty Orbell, who's the Vice President now at Hub International. Congrats on the promotion, by the way.
Breaking news.
I said, I am now the VP. I said, oh my, I am intimidated. So you know the deal. Many topics per usual. We have seven today. We'll start, Rich, with, capital punishment.
Speaking of Kasem, go from an up-tempo intro to the capital punishment.
What a great start.
But bigly, we need to cover legal news on this show. So, the federal government has announced that capital punishment is being reinstated in this country. Bill Barr, who is the acting attorney general, or now attorney general, he has ordered the Bureau of Prisons to schedule executions for five inmates who are currently on death row. Each of these people were convicted of murdering children, among others. The Justice Department, according to Bill Barr, is upholding the rule of law, and we owe it to the victims and their families to carry forward the sentence imposed by our justice system, said Barr. So, there has been a moratorium, on capital punishment in this country for many years, but it is still legal, so it is coming back. The U.S. is one of the only countries left who are now going to kill people on death row. What are our thoughts on this, Tina? I mean, the capital punishment issue obviously is one fraught with many opinions and, lots of strong feelings on either side. These people obviously were convicted of some incredibly, among the most heinous crimes you will ever see. One of them killed five people, including two children. Another one tortured and killed his daughter. So is this a good move? Some are criticizing it as an effort by Trump to appease the right wing of his party in anticipation of the 2020 elections. So what are your thoughts, Tina, on all that?
Well, I do think it's obviously a very political move by Trump. And so, putting that aside, my personal feelings on capital punishment, I used to actually believe in it. And as I've gotten older, and I'd like to think wiser, I'm not a fan of capital punishment. And especially with what we've seen over the years where people get wrongfully convicted, and to put somebody to death that didn't do it is a pretty awful thing. And I'm of the opinion that it's not really our place to be making those kinds of decisions about people.
Patty, Kamala Harris, who is a senator from California who is running for president, who is trying to replace Trump, has tweeted yesterday that capital punishment is immoral and deeply flawed. Too many innocent people have been put to death. We need a national moratorium on the death penalty, not a resurrection. We have obviously seen many examples, especially in Chicago, of people who have been convicted of crimes, who have spent years in some cases on or behind bars, some on death row, who have later been exonerated. Do you think that's a risk if capital punishment is back, that we will execute innocent people?
Absolutely, it's a risk. I just don't agree with this at all. I think that we really need to look at, there's two different things that I focused on in my mind was the, you know, how the mental capacity of the folks that were putting to death and the mental capacity when they were committing the crimes. If these are folks that are mentally impaired from, you know, a physiological standpoint, it's really sad to me that they would be put to death. The other thing is the cost analysis of keeping these inmates in jail versus the putting them to death. I mean, all the appeals and everything. Has anyone done any studies on the cost? Is it cheaper? Is it cheaper to keep them in jail for their life? Or is it, you know, because ultimately it's our dollar that's paying for this.
Sure. Alex, you and I are from Canada originally. You're a fellow McGill University alum like myself.
Red man.
Canada has been capital punishment has been outlawed in Canada since 1976. Canada considers itself much more of a progressive country than the United States. What are your thoughts on this issue, having grown up like I did in another country that doesn't kill people?
Well, the first thing that stands out with this is sort of a departure from the Republican ideals of federal mandates versus individual states' rights. You know, you always associate, to be broad, Democrats more with larger federal-based programs, as opposed to individual states being able to do as they wish. This goes against all that. Is it a statement from Trump? Sounds like that's what we're saying here. But it's just such a departure from what they normally do.
Some would say hypocritical, right? I mean,
very
interesting point because, if you believe in the Republican principle that states should get to decide things on their own and not be mandated by the federal government, then the Fed shouldn't come in and say that we're going to execute people across the whole country. I think that's an excellent point.
And how does that play to the 20 states where it's illegal?
Right.
How are they going to be affected by that? Are they going to be overruled or is it going to go to some levels of court?
Along the same lines, a lot of people who criticize Republicans for this look at, you know, the issue of the sanctity of life. So on the one hand, you believe that all life is precious and a woman shouldn't have the right to terminate a life, yet the federal government should have the right to terminate a life in this other situation. So, you know, there's a lot of hypocrisy that some people find in this decision as an example of just political, you know, it's just a political move.
I never did address your point about growing up in Canada and not having a death penalty. It's a bit of a shock that it still exists. I will leave it at that.
Yeah.
And with that, let's transition to Yelp, from capital punishment to Yelp, where posting a negative review online can now get you sued.
Sometimes I do wish some of the Yelp reviewers were executed, by the way, because they're not accurate. Oh, sometimes I read a review and it's like a 5-star and I go eat there and I want to throw up. I'm like, if anyone should be executed, it's the person who wrote this terrible.
Well, they can't be now.
Yeah,
so what do you do? So like if you see a bad review, though, does that really, you know, sort of color what you decide to do?
I will not. Well, yes. I think the stat was 85% of people look at some kind of review, Yelp, TripAdvisor, mm-hmm. before they will do anything. And I mean, I think it's like 100% because the first thing I do when I go to any new restaurant or even existing restaurants, I want to see what's going on, what people are thinking. And if you're like me, I automatically look at the negative one. There could be like 15 good ones and I just jump on the negative one because I want to see if there's like rat droppings and excrement.
What if there are 70 reviews and there's one
star focused on the bed
that says F this place?
I'm that guy. Yeah, no, I will generally look at that one. But this story is really interesting because we all look at reviews. Some of us post. I posted a couple. I will post when I'm really impassioned by either it's incredible, but more likely if it's really bad. I've posted a couple. But now you could get sued, right? There is a man in Florida who thought that he was just posting a normal review, and he spent a lot of money and a year in court because he was sued by the owner of this, what was it, a veterinary clinic?
Yep.
Yes.
He was upset, understandably, that his dog died, and his review said that they didn't take care of the dog quickly enough, and had they done that, they could have saved the dog. So he wrote a fairly negative review. Well, guess what? The owners of the DeLand Animal Hospital and the veterinarian, Thomas McPhail, sued him, alleging defamation, saying that his statements were false and published maliciously and recklessly. And he spent, $26,000 in legal bills. Who thought lawyers could be that expensive, Tina? Which was more than his $20,000 yearly Social Security income. So now, in the world we live in, you can be sued for posting a negative Yelp review. Is that good or bad? If I'm the business owner, maybe I want the ability to sue someone who has criticized me on Yelp. But thoughts?
I think it's a bit egregious to be able to if this suit is successful. I think they've settled out of court. But I think it's outrageous that you set up a system like this, you know, to give feedback, whether it's positive or negative, and then somebody can sue for a negative review. Now, I think the only exception to that is if truly defamatory or slanderous comments are made. But, you know, we both know, Rich, that the standard for that is pretty steep.
Right, and the ultimate defense to any defamation
is the truth.
And
right.
If you're opining,
his dog's dead.
Right, I mean, if you're opining on something, I didn't like this meal, that's the truth, right? Your opinion is that you didn't like it. So it gets a little tricky. There's something called there's SLAP litigation in many states. SLAP stands for Strategic Lawsuit Against Public Participation. So you are seeing a rise in a lot of these lawsuits where SLAP litigation is in place. But guys, what do you think? Are you more likely or less likely to either read a review or more importantly file a review or post one because of what you're hearing about these lawsuits?
You know, keep the negative reviews coming. I like reading them because you get the real picture.
The truth.
You get the truth. And that's what really disturbed me about this article was the dog owner who, you know, lost his dog told the truth in the review. And so where is the protection for the general public who are telling the truth? And the business owners obviously have deeper pockets than this poor gentleman who's only on a Social Security income. And so I just don't get it. I just had to scratch my head and think, what country are we living in? This doesn't sound right.
Yeah, and to that point, many people who sue under SLAP aren't looking for, you know, justice, or they're not, you know, it's not a First Amendment issue. They're just looking to shut down that actual negative review. Alex, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, a couple of points. One, it's not an accredited news source. It's an opinion blog page. There's no fact. It's opinion. So is there a little line that you can cross where you do actual damage that with unfactual postings about a certain, you know, say there was a rat in a restaurant, but there wasn't. Could that be sued because it wasn't true?
Right.
Potentially. This, to me, is just a Yelp review that the owner didn't like.
He's not alone, by the way. There have been many examples. We covered this a few months ago. There's many examples of other people, other business owners going after reviewers. So I think it is a trend that we'll see. Sam, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I work in a bar. I tend bar. And if you have a disagreement, unfortunately, with any of the customers, even if they may be inebriated and six shots of tequila deep, and they start an argument with you or they start a fight in the crowd, and you try and break the fight up, you're the bad guy. And I think that's the problem. And a lot of bar owners really can't stand Yelp because anything that the customer doesn't like, they not only trash the owner or the bartender, they review with one star.
That's interesting. How much
you know what I'm saying? So it's different depending on how you view it.
Yeah, it's interesting. How much do you think people's behavior is now affected? And some of that's a good thing, right? I mean, some of it's good because you're worried about Yelp, but how much do you think like a bar owner or a server's behavior is affected by the potential negative review on a Yelp or whatever?
Let me answer your question with a different question. If you were a bar owner or a manager and you had to escort somebody out and they were yelling as they're being escorted out, "Wait till I Yelp you!" Would your opinion change on Yelp?
Yeah, I think it would.
Right.
I mean, you know, the good part of Yelp is there's some accountability, right? If you do truly get bad service, then there's some accountability. But I always like when I see the owner fight back on Yelp. I always like when I see an owner of a hotel or restaurant say, "Oh, here's why I disagree." I don't like when I see the boilerplate ones because those are just like robots. But, you know, there is an opportunity for the bar owner in your example to actually fight back and give their side of the story.
And he does fight back.
Literally,
he does. No, with his keyboard.
I thought he sent you out to take care of
yes,
business.
We just scour the Yelp from now on. So Tina, sad story. Obviously, Lorenzen Wright, and that case has come to a close with the ex-wife pleading guilty.
Yes. Well, I'm hoping that we're trending towards this case closing. So it's been almost 9 years exactly since former NBA player Lorenzen Wright, who ended his career with the Cavaliers, was found murdered in a wooded area. I think it was in Memphis. So it took about 7 years of investigating for the road to lead to his ex-wife, Shara Wright, as well as someone that she knew, who is Billy Turner. So what happened was she was indicted a couple of years ago on charges of first-degree murder, conspiracy to commit first-degree murder, and attempted first-degree murder. Interestingly, she appeared in court yesterday. It was unscheduled, and she ended up pleading guilty to facilitation to commit first-degree murder and to commit attempted first-degree murder, and when she had previously pled not guilty. She was given a 30-year sentence after entering her guilty plea, and she will be eligible for parole in 9 years. The co-defendant, Billy Turner, is scheduled to stand trial on charges of first-degree murder in the next few weeks. Very sad story. The thinking was that she decided to plead guilty because she knew that Billy Ray Turner was going to turn on her and was expected to suck her in even more than she's already involved. And she claims as a defense that she was being severely beaten. And she decided to plead guilty because she's got 6 children and she wants to minimize the amount of time that she's apart from them. So very sad story.
What I remembered about this story when I saw it this week was the 911 tape that came out where Lorenzen Wright dials 911. You just hear a scream, and then you hear like 7 or 8 shots that got a lot of publicity. But yeah, sad story. Guys, is it, does this, you know, teach you anything about, I think one lesson is, you know, good for the police to stay on the case. That murder cases obviously have no statute of limitations. This case is now being solved, and this person is finally being brought to justice, you know, almost a decade later. So that's, you know, good news on a very sad story.
All right, let's move on.
Yeah.
How about Meek Mill? Let's go from Lorenzen Wright to Meek Mill, who has been granted a new trial and a new judge in a past conviction. So Meek Mill, obviously very pleased about this.
Yeah, Meek Mill's a rapper out of Philly who got a lot of attention about a year and a half ago because the owner of the Eagles, I believe it was, came out and, you know, among many other celebrities, including Jay-Z and many, or it was the Sixers, sorry. The owner of the Sixers was supporting Meek Mill because they felt that he was getting a raw deal. And very famously, the owner of the Sixers sent his helicopter to pick up Meek Mill from jail.
To ring the bell before a playoff game.
To ring the bell, exactly.
Right.
So now it turns out that the Superior Court of Pennsylvania just Wednesday announced its decision. It was an 18-page opinion stating that he would likely be acquitted if the case were retried because of some newly discovered evidence and have dropped the charges. So turns out Meek Mill was right, Sam. He did not do what he was accused of doing. And there's a lot of people on social media who are understandably very pleased with this. So, guys, what do you think? Is this an example of, you know, Meek Mill did have a past history. He did have some prior criminal issues. But in this particular case, he had asserted very strongly that he was innocent. Do you think sometimes rappers in particular get a raw deal just because of the whole image that of the industry that they're in? Is this an example of that? Any thoughts?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, Rich, you and I were growing up, you know, or 80s and 90s when it seemed like there was a whole series and slew of rappers that ended up getting murdered, you know, drive-bys and whatnot. And so I think that there is, unfortunately, this image that is not necessarily a fair one, and that as a result, people end up getting getting the raw end of the deal.
Well, it's interesting also, just kicking it back to our capital punishment story, the overwhelming amount of people who are serving time in federal prison now, and those 5 prisoners who are being executed are being handled by the federal government, all for different reasons. One was on a military base, one was on a Native reservation. The overwhelming majority of people on death row are African Americans, mm-hmm. And they're inordinately found guilty of felonies. Yet, I think 4 out of the 5 of the capital punishment prisoners are white. You know, so there is this issue, I think, in our system. and speaking to the issue of decriminalizing marijuana. I mean, it's all part of the idea that I think there's a movement to recognize that the criminal justice system has treated some minorities unfairly. And I think Meek Mill is probably a good example of that. Guys, what do you all think about that?
I mean, it's hard to look, look past what's been going on just beyond this one. You know, you look at the Eric Garner case just a couple of weeks ago. The cop ended up getting off scot-free. The cops here in Chicago that were involved with Laquan McDonald were let go of their positions for the cover-up. But now you're talking about the cover-up of a murder. Is that commensurate with losing your job versus any legal ramifications? I don't necessarily think so. You also have the element of the article with Meek Mill where we're saying that one other officer determined that he had not tried to point the gun at them. He had tried to actually put it away. So, this isn't to me about hip hop and rappers. This is about race relations in this country that there's no shortage of cases that make you scratch your head. And this is just another one of them.
Yeah, Patty, Meek Mill's attorney has said that they haven't considered a civil suit. That they're just happy that he's no longer a convicted felon. Do you think we'll see maybe a civil suit in the wake of this, despite what his attorney has said? You frequently see, some civil action as a result of this as well.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think we'll see it for sure. I think going back to the very beginning of the article where they talked about why he was at first convicted, 2008, he was convicted for drug and gun conviction where he was just found guilty for possessing drugs and holding a firearm up at a detective. He was 19 years old. And he was given 10 years of probation, served 8 months in prison for that. It just is mind-boggling to me because I'm a big Twitter fan, and a lot of the people I follow, they go through the differences between what the young 19-year-old white kid's getting, the rich kid from the suburbs versus the inner city kids. And it's just, to me, that was the start of this.
On the other hand, those guys who threw the water at those cops in New York, they should be, the book should be thrown at them. That was terrible. Did you see that, Sam?
No.
There's a video of two cops in, it was New York, right?
Yeah.
I think?
Yeah, yeah.
And there's a crowd of people around them, and they douse these two officers with water. One of them throws a bucket at the head of the other, and they're soaking wet, and they don't do anything. They don't arrest them. They don't do anything to retaliate. And it's a shame that these police officers were treated so terribly and didn't do anything to retaliate. But
maybe we should Yelp those jerks. What do you think?
There you go.
I don't know if the NYPD has a Yelp account.
Mm. Okay.
It might overload the Yelp server.
It would break the internet.
Exactly.
Our next topic on this very heavy legal grab bag, I might add. Oh, my God.
Yeah, can we lighten it up a little bit?
Well, how about this? How about a knife, a gun, and Katy Perry?
There you go.
Now.
This
is a good one. This is a good one.
Yeah, it's amazing how intellectual property law can end up with people wielding knives and altercations at the courthouse. So there's been a lot of headlines lately about Katy Perry and her producers getting sued for copyright infringement involving her hit from 2013, Dark Horse.
Was it a hit? I've never heard of it.
I actually like it. I remember when it came out.
Dark Horse?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I stand corrected.
Can you sing it for us, Tina?
You do not want me singing.
And will you be sued by her if you sing it on there?
Yeah, probably. I'll be sued for some kind of infringement, not necessarily copyright, but maybe blowing people's eardrums out. But anyway, so there's a Christian rap group that created this or wrote this song, Joyful Noise, and they claim that Dark Horse is infringing. So there's this case going on in the federal courthouse in Los Angeles, and earlier this week during the trial, one of the courthouse security officers shot a guy who was in an altercation at the courthouse who was wielding a knife. And so apparently there was also another person who was taken into custody at the same time. And so all this was going on.
Never has an intellectual property case been so
I'm telling
exciting.
You. It is. Oh, come on. We do a lot of fun stuff.
Yes,
but I have to say Katy Perry in L.A. with a guy wielding a knife. That's pretty exciting
but
stuff.
But yes, she was also seen, I think I saw her like jumping off a cliff somewhere with, who's she dating? Come on, Sam, you're on top of the, is it, what's his name, Orlando Bloom?
It was Russell Brand. But I think that's
like
that's a while ago,
buddy. That's like
so. Don't ask me then.
All right, but listen. Have you listened to? I did the play by play. Right. If you go on YouTube, you can hear the two songs mm-hmm. next
right.
to each other.
Right.
The beginning is remarkably similar. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've covered so many of these cases mm-hmm. that you know the answer traditionally is that all music is derivative in some way, right? And you know, a lot of music sounds alike. Whether it rises to the level
of copyright infringement,
is for Tina to tell us, and for ultimately this jury to tell us.
Quick fact check: it is Orlando Bloom.
Ah, you see.
Okay. Well, you know, it's interesting because obviously you bring experts in to testify on this stuff, and they testified. I think it was the week before last about it, and said that they chalked it up to mere coincidence. The similarities between the two songs.
Did you listen to the
two songs? I actually did. And I mean, I it's not as bad as I've heard some other comparisons before. So, but I hear some similarities.
What do you think? When you hear these kind of lawsuits where, I mean, you're in the creative field, yep. Alex, and, you know, all art can be seen as derivative in some way, right? I mean, you're in the filmmaking
right.
space, and
well, absolutely,
you know, there are tributes all the time of filmmakers who, you know, make movies that are very similar to other filmmakers who are the heroes. Where's the line between tribute and copying?
Well, you have 88 keys. There is a finite amount of right. combinations. However, Dr. Luke, whose real name is Lucas Gottwald, who's one of the producers behind Katy Perry, this isn't his first time dealing with this. The plot thickens in two particular ways. One, he had some major allegations against him with his former artist named Keisha, where it was a
that would be Kesha, I believe.
I'm sorry. There's also a Kesha dollar sign in
yeah,
there.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't have the dollar sign.
Dollar
silent.
Sign, huh? But, let's get it right.
But you know, she sued him for defamation. Well, actually, for sexual allegations, and then it turned into sort of a countersuit from Dr. Luke against her for defamation. He ended up winning. You know, sort of the story of the big record labels, a small independent producer who signs a contract when she's too young, etc. So this guy is not. Exactly, he doesn't have a sterling reputation. The thing that made me think of was about 3 or 4 or 5 years ago was the Blurred Lines song with Robin Thicke and Pharrell Williams. That was a song that was taken from a Marvin Gaye song that went to court, and the Marvin Gaye estate won, I believe,
$5.8 million.
And so $5.8 million plus 50% of the publishing and songwriting royalties moving forward from that one song. Some song, you know, I don't know how they do it. I mean, it's not a mathematical equation, but there is a way that you can look at the music, and I can't imagine it's a lawyer, but probably some kind of music.
Well, like Tina said, I mean, you bring in experts, and you know, we have the jury system, and ultimately, like anything else, I mean, the American system is based on not 12 experts being in there, but 12 lay people listening to the evidence. Ultimately, it's for the jury to decide whether these songs are similar enough mm-hmm. that one copied from the other. I mean, we just covered recently the Tina's favorite band from the 90s, The Verve, Bittersweet Symphony.
The Stones, yeah.
Yeah, they finally resolved their issue. You with Sympathy for the Devil. Not that one. The other Rolling Stones song, it escapes me now, but they just resolved that issue after litigating it for like 30 years.
Many years.
So
who ended up winning that?
Keith and Mick finally gave up their credits.
The rights.
They gave them the rights to the song, and it's now just The Verve.
It's Richard Ashcroft.
Right. So they gave up on that. But Patty, what are your thoughts on
maybe that's what gave him his
these
heart
kind
attack.
Of lawsuits? And what's your favorite Katy Perry song, most importantly?
Well, Hot and Cold, for sure.
Ah, there you go.
Yep,
that's one that I know.
Other than that, being in insurance, I don't have a lot of creative vibes going on here.
That's a cop-out. If I ever heard one.
No one copying insurance policies and being sued for it.
Well, maybe there are. Yeah. But so I think if I were creative and I thought someone took my creative product, I would definitely go after it. So
don't take the law into your own hands. Take him to court.
Absolutely. Right. Hire a good attorney.
The people's court.
Federal court.
That's right.
Should we talk about the vaping judge now? I think the vaping judge is
next.
Do
a little maybe selfie on the... Or can I guess maybe you can.
Do we want to have...
I want to see the Cardinal shirt that Sam's wearing today.
Do we want to have a moment in silence for Rembrandt, the poor dog that died of... A ruptured spleen.
I think we should.
Yes, because of the bad veterinary people.
Let's give him 5 seconds.
Absolutely.
Okay. Good.
That wasn't 5 seconds.
Well, that was for Rembrandt.
That was.
It was
seconds.
In dog's life.
It was yes.
Shorter.
It was a dog 5 seconds.
So the vaping judge, Tina.
I just love
this story.
Can you read the headline, please?
I love this story. Courtesy of ABA Journal. I have to give credit where credit is due. Judge told to stop vaping on the bench. Motion claimed he was, quote, constantly slurping on the device. Mm. That's all you need to know. So, Judge Russo in Cleveland, what were you thinking? So he was asked to stop smoking e-cigarettes earlier this year after a juror complained. And so now he is no longer vaping in court. So apparently he would vape like during trials.
Is that wrong? Is that wrong? Apparently no one told this
yes.
guy. That seems like nitpicking.
I mean, I don't think that you'd see a judge smoking in court. So why should they be allowed to vape? So the motion claimed he was constantly slurping and sucking on the vaping device during the bench trial. And actually, there were allegations that it altered his brain chemistry and could have affected the outcome of the case. So yeah, I love this case. I think it's fantastic.
We've seen some weird behavior in court, guys, over the course of our careers. But yeah, I've never seen a judge smoking or vaping. Not yet.
I mean, what about slurping?
Was there something else in the vape that would cause you to slurp and have brain alterations? Because it doesn't sound like what you buy in the store.
Yeah, I don't know. It sounds like there was something good going on, at least for him in that and his vaping tendencies that he indulged in court. So,
well, I mean, the laws say that if you can't smoke tobacco, cigarettes or cigars, you can't vape in any restaurant or bar. So wouldn't it kind of still be the same?
No, well.
Apparently the judge disagreed, though, because he denied the motion, even though the movement claimed that it was altering the judge's mental chemistry, as you said.
Yes.
So I don't get that. So the judge was able to deny the own motion.
No, another judge.
Oh, okay. Oh.
Yeah. It would be weird if he denied his own judge, right?
Yeah.
Or his own motion, I think.
It is Ohio.
That's how I read it.
It is Ohio. You know, anything really goes in Ohio.
He's also a common pleas judge, which I'm not sure what that is.
Is that pretty low down?
Sounds like it, although I'm not up to my low-level Ohio judicial rules.
Okay, you're disparaging Cleveland people. Yes. I know them, and they're nice people.
Last topic, and I'll just give you the brief synopsis of what this says on the rundown. Courthouse parachuting. Let's wrap it up with courthouse parachuting.
This is another great story. So a Naperville attorney that in February decided that he was going to jump from the top of the 10-story under construction Will County Courthouse pled guilty to criminal trespass earlier this week. He did it in the middle of the night, was found by two police officers who then arrested him once he landed in the parking lot of the police department, which was across the street. So I think that this is actually hilarious. The county judge said he thought to himself that when he read about it, that this had to be probably the stupidest person he's ever met before he issued the fine of $600 and have said that he was going to sentence this guy to 12 months court supervision and 100 hours of community service.
So many questions. I've been in that courthouse a lot. I'm there fairly frequently. I've never parachuted off the roof.
But you would. But I mean, wouldn't you?
Well, you haven't met Adam Wirtz,
obviously. Is a courthouse roof enough space to parachute? Like, you would think it wouldn't be a small chute. Yeah. That's enough, really?
He went down probably like that.
So it doesn't seem like there'd be enough space to like rip the cord.
Yeah, rough landing. He probably broke his legs.
Guys, does this make you fearful about the stupidity of attorneys? Or?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
we know why.
We got some smart ones in the room here today.
Why he's doing? We don't know that, right?
Well, he actually said that the quote was something kind of ridiculous. He said that he had done it because it was a building that had value.
Yeah.
He was on something, I would think, for like a justification.
He was on the roof.
He was on Face-Off in about 2 weeks. I was going to say
sitting in those chairs right there.
I was going to say bath salts, but I was way off the mark on that one.
Coming up on Legal Face-Off, the parachuting, he'd be a good get for our show.
I would love to come by and just meet him if he comes by.
Yeah.
I don't have to be on the show.
Well, he has to offer free legal services. He's got to do community service at Prairie State Legal Services and volunteer at an animal shelter.
We got to ask. The judge said it was the dumbest thing that he's ever seen in the 2 or 3 minutes we've got left. Let's go around the room. The dumbest thing you've ever done that you could admit to on the air. Come on. Anything?
I plead the fifth.
What? No fifth on this show. I see you guys thinking. I've done a lot of dumb things.
God.
Many, many things in my life. I'm trying to think of which of
there's
them
there's so many of them that that Rich can't scroll through them all
on the air.
I've said a lot of bad things. Yeah. I have to say that.
I don't think these are air legal.
No, probably not airable.
I mean, you know me. I mean,
well, keep it clean, Rich.
All right. Well, we'll have to vet them and maybe add them to the next show.
I can go back to being like 10 years old and shooting friends with Roman candles. I mean, we don't talk about that. I'm not going to talk about all the people that I've robbed over the years. Yeah.
Oh my God. Okay, I've got one. So in college, it was we were getting ready to graduate. It was a pretty long day of heavy drinking, and a friend of mine, her car ended up, we were out so late that the place that she parked her car, they had fenced off the parking lot. And so her car was stuck in the parking lot. So she and I, well, I climbed the barbed wire fence first, and it was like 15 feet high. And I jumped over and was able to unlock the gate so we could get her car out. And then we sat in her car for 4 hours until she sobered up. So
seemed like a good idea.
But you know what? I at least was able to take care of my friend, and we sobered up together in our car.
Well, I've got one from
Hold on. And the barbed wire?
No. We pulled her car out. I opened the latch.
You climbed the.
Yeah, and then I jumped over, and we got her car out. I opened the gate. But got her car out.
You didn't get cut by the barbed wire?
Was there barbed wire?
No, I was. It was Barbie, but I was able to not. I had jeans on, so I did not hurt myself.
Ripping the barbed wire with your legs. Were they leather chaps?
They were on not. Top of your jeans? No.
We're getting a whole image here.
She buried the most important. Yeah, exactly. I climbed the barbed wire fence and didn't get covered
over.
In blood. Wow.
I was a lot more flexible back then.
Well, I got one that just came to mind. July 4th, as you guys call it in this country, Independence Day, we were doing some fireworks. Maybe they were, from another state, maybe not, but they weren't the most stable of fireworks, maybe, and maybe we had a couple drinks, and one of them actually went sideways and ended up under a parked car.
Ooh.
Luckily, it didn't go off, but I have some PTSD about the image of what could have happened.
You could play for the New York Giants.
Exactly. I could have been the three-finger
Pierre Paul.
The Giants. So.
Wow.
Not the best move of
definitely not a good thing.
I think we'll let our guests off the hot seat. We don't need them to incriminate themselves, right? Okay. All right. That does it. Well, Alex and Patty, thank you both for coming in and joining us.
Thank you.
This has been great.
For Rich and Tina, my name is Sam. Thank you, Ben Anderson. We'll talk to you in 2 weeks here on Legal Faceoff.
It's Christina Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Faceoff. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget the politics. It don't get no better than this, nah. Courtroom combat going hand to hand.